You are listening to Natural Born Alchemist.
Welcome to episode number 342 of the Natural Born Alchemist podcast. My name is Alex and I will be your host. And I hope you follow me on X at Born Alchemist and elsewhere in social media, but I mainly use X. And also subscribe to my YouTube channel and Rumble. Now I also have Rumble. Just search for Natural Born Alchemist. All the links are in the program notes. And I've started releasing my History of Alchemy series. It's a separate podcast. I hope you can subscribe to it. You'll find it on Spotify and Apple Podcasts as well. But it's also made visually. So that's why I mention YouTube and Rumble. So check that out. In this episode, my guest is Ricardo Carvalho, if I say that correctly. Ricardo is an independent researcher at the Institute for Natural Philosophy. And we discuss many aspects of history, but something I find interesting is the topic of archaeoacoustics, which is a subfield of archaeology and acoustics. And it studies the relationship between people and sound throughout history. I'm not sure why, but Ricardo's sound didn't come out so good in the recording. For some strange reason, I tried to improve it as good as I could, and it's a bit ironic considering the topic is archaeoacoustics. But I'm sure I'll have Ricardo back, and then we will make sure the sound is excellent. Regardless, let's dive into it. So thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Very honored to be here. I've heard a few of your podcasts, but I didn't even knew that you do interviews or talks. I just thought it was you alone.
Most of them are me not alone, but I guess it's because if you've been listening recently, I've been more alone more recently because I've been less interested in reaching out to people. So I'm more particular with that. Anyway, but tell the listeners who you are and what you do.
Sure. So my name is Ricardo Carvalho. I have a YouTube channel. It's called History, Myths, and Legends. I'm on X as at Ricardo Carvalho 1. I recently created with Phil from AAV and a colleague of ours called Guilherme. Has a difficult name to say on X, so I won't repeat it. We created the Institute for Natural Philosophy about 2 months ago, and we are very much embedded in trying to make it work and try to make it official, academic, in order for us to actually can go on sites and do our own testing. We are very much interested in archaeoacoustics, telluric energies, archaeoastronomic data. So we are trying to take the actual tests that have been done already, and there are many, but actually take them to the level that no academic takes, because as soon as things start to get, let's put it this way, strange, academics usually close the research. I can give you an example. Many years ago, perhaps 15, 16 years ago, a team was studying inside the king's chamber, and they brought a musician, all the paraphernalia, all the instruments, everything. And when the fellow decided to start turning things up in terms of sound frequencies and creating standing waves, so a standing wave is when you have a sound, there is emitted with another identical sound. It can even be the same frequency, the same tone, the same note, for people that are not into this. The thing is, they are emitted with a very little delay. So imagine 3 or 4 points of a second in difference. And when the sound waves start colliding with one another, they start to compress and they can create a standing wave. And when that happened on the King's Chamber, What happened is that the guy that was creating the sound suddenly turned around and everyone was fleeing, running away, because one of the things that the ancient sites have, and this is what we have been studying and this is what we have been researching and doing papers on, is that these sites can create both feelings of awe or feelings of fear. And this fear is something that our minds don't clearly understand because we don't see the source creating that fear. And what happens is people just run away. So this has happened all over the site, all over the world. They just don't go beyond the point where the stones start vibrating and things start to get weird.
So do you think that that's how they built the pyramids, using sound in some way that moves heavy objects?
Well, we have not yet dealt with Egypt, and I can explain you why. Because although it's very much the site that everyone likes, and it's a country that we very much wish to study archaeacoustics there, it's incredible how the study of archaeacoustics is actually zero. The only things you have is a few studies from voice propagation from inside the temples into the outside of temples, but we are talking not pyramids, we're talking actual temples, columns, and so on. And the only thing that is remarkable on that is that the sound is louder on the outside of the temple for the people that are outside than it is for the people that are inside. Something that also happens, for instance, in Al Safliani Hypogeum in Malta, where if you are in the oracle room, for instance, and the sound is being projected by the niche, it's a small hole on the wall that leads to another chamber. So the oracle would be on the other wall, and the people receiving the information from the oracle would be in the oracle room. It has, for instance, the effect that those that are outside listen to what is being said into the oracle room in what can be called a different language. It's not actually a different language, but it's mumbo jumbo, so it can't be understood. However, if you project the sound from another point, then the rooms that are further away from the sound projection are louder than the sounds, than the people that are closest to the actual source of that sound. So this is the kind of thing that has been studied in Egypt, but there are no official papers, studies that actually report archaeoacoustics in either of the most known sites in Egypt, which is very strange because it's a place that we know it will have very, very good results. For instance, I can say that the theories that were presented many years ago of the pyramid to be some sort of a pump, we now see that that information is being added to the fact that the pump, it's not for irrigation at some sort before, but that pump is actually to create resonance, to create an emission of sound. It's like, I'm going to do it here. It's like you hear. So controlling the flow of that pump, that's why there are so many channels connecting the Nile to the pyramid itself. When you control that frequency, you can create various effects within this vast array between awe and fear. So, and the awe and fear, I keep repeating it because it's the thing that you see in every single academic paper, be it by the SRBG, that is the protocol which academics now follow when doing archaeacoustics, that was created by Paul De Bartolis, which curiously comes from a dental university, but he is the leading figure in studying archaeacoustics in the world. He has a team with 30 plus members in multidisciplinary areas that are doing research all over the world, and they'll keep on finding exactly the same things. But the problem is they pick these things and they don't actually see where they lead. They believe it's all a creation in the mind, that nothing that people see, hallucinate, or, and when I say see, I actually say see. So academics think it all happens in southern Mainz. You have a site, for instance, that it's called the city of Alatri in Italy, where visitors are often subject to hallucinations. In fact, there is even, you can go and see, there are many pages saying that there are ghosts in Alatri, or even in Groparello, that's another site in Italy. What happens is actually the frequencies are messing with people's minds.
I haven't come across much information on like sound, and when you look at the past, it could explain a lot, even all the senses, even smell. So when they talk about cave art and all that stuff, I've never really seen that they mention that if you are in a cave and you are doing paintings there and having rituals, it's also a very good place for the sound if you're drumming or doing stuff like that. And I did once a psychedelic ceremony in a, like, it was in a stone structure. It wasn't a cave, but it was a very, it was a cave-like man-made structure. And they were burning a lot of incense there. And it became quite intense with the smell as well. So smell and sound is often left out. And it's weird that when they have a team of scientists, if they go to Giza, for instance, to the pyramids, why don't they have an archaeologist, a sound guy, a smell guy, and maybe some indigenous person who doesn't think like the rest, and like have a biologist? They have one of each. They never like have any synergy. They all always also compartmentalized in different departments, and that's why there's no real results, maybe.
Yeah, well, there are, you would be surprised with the amount of studies that there are on archaeacoustics. For instance, we just finished a paper that will be the base of the institute itself. It's called the Statement of Significance. And the bibliography alone is about 290 papers. So there are a lot of papers on archaeoacoustics. What you don't have is actually common knowledge that those documents actually exist, although they are accessible to public in their majority. But and relating to what you said, that is very, very interesting, because let me tell you that when you go to the most primitive sites that are actually studied for sound, the first thing they noted is, imagine you have a site in Spain that has about nearly a mile of a cliff that is all excavated. So imagine through that cliff you have half an eggshell dug into the rock itself. I don't know if you're creating the image, but imagine that, or half a coconut that is excavated in that cliff. The thing is, only 17 of those have ancient art on the walls. And those are the only ones that have sound capabilities. In this case, they were using the sound to communicate to up to 100 hectares in area. So an hectare is 10,000 square meters. So imagine someone that was on the vast, on the opposite side of the plane, could communicate with those that were seated inside those niches that are created within this cliff. So communication was essential. We recently found out papers that are completely ignored, showing that, for instance, in the Mediterranean, there was from Malta to the coast of Africa, there are systems of communication that use the fact that the water creates a surface of cool air. Obviously, this can be done only in calm waters, but the Mediterranean is almost always calm. So what happens is they projected the sound into these half-circle temples that you can find in many places in Malta and the surrounding islands. And the sound was being projected from one place to 100 kilometers away, or 60 miles. From that point, it was then projected again, so it was easy to communicate all over the Mediterranean using this system. And this is not mentioned, and yet it is academic. So two things that, to finish this thought and let you speak, the two things important here to see is that those that found these acoustic sounds usually mark the site with paintings, and those paintings are often in the shape of sound, either wave, either what most people consider to be the omphalos, or the belly button of the world, these coeccentric circles. So they actually describe in art what they were actually doing. It's not innocent, it's not accidental, it's purposeful, it's intentional. They knew exactly what they are doing. And then this evolved to the creation of temples, as you see, as I spoke before, the House of Vieni, the Tarxian temples, sites that were built from the ground up exactly to exert this function of sound over the mind. For instance, in Long West Kennet, there is some sort of a tomb. They call it tombs, but they are not tombs. We found that there is a ratio of 4/3, and the sound that is introduced to those sites actually is reproduced in 4/3 terms for those that understand music. So it's not accidental. Everything has been done purposefully, intentionally. This is not something that the ancients found by accident after building the sites. It was done for exactly those same purposes, be it for information, be it for relief, being for creating the feelings of fear among enemies. If you use the site correctly, you could prevent an invasion. This sounds very far-fetched, but it's completely real. And even today, there are techniques of sound there are weapons of sound that are more or less prohibited, but they actually are using this technique today as they used many years ago. Just remember Jericho. Remember all the myths about warriors blowing their horns and the enemies fleeing in fear. You have the case of Gorbarello Castle that was unconquered for almost 500 years because it has a system that we see replicated everywhere of this type. There is beneath, you have some sort of a room like an hypogeum. Then the Romans decided to increase the power by building a bigger tower on top of it. And that tower creates an infrasound that is specially active in creating feelings of fear if the sound is compressed. So everyone outside the gates of the castle, they are protected, and this is not fiction, they are protected by magnetic vortices that are created by sound itself. So everyone that crosses that threshold, immediately its brain is reprogrammed into that same frequency, but into a feeling of awe, of unity, of divine presence, of like a hive mentality, while those outside just cannot go on because they feel disorientated, they are dizziness, they are fear, they are lost of motor control. So no one could reach the castle because of the use of this technology. And we are seeing it replicated in many other sites that academics just don't care about.
It's interesting. I'm thinking about the ley lines. Many temples have been built along ley lines or sacred sites, and the ley lines have a theory that those positions vibrate. So that could be connected, and with the string theory that the whole universe is a vibration. So maybe sound was more important to the ancient peoples more than today. Maybe today we have so much sound that we don't really hear the true sounds we should hear. We're too distracted with all the other sounds. I mean, I know on a personal level, for social reasons and not wanting to be disturbed by the society around me, I always have sound in headphones. You know.
Well, I understand you, but you need to realize one thing when speaking about the ley lines, because I got that. And I'm not sure if you do, but I did got that wrong. I thought the ley lines were the package that came with telluric energies. And in fact, ley lines is just one of the type of telluric energies. Because you have many others like the Hartmann grid, the Curie grid, the Weyl vortices. You have the Becker and Hegger's grid. It's the one that we see more posted. You have the black lines. You have the, and ultimately you have the potential portals. So ley lines is just one of the types of telluric energies that we have. They're more linked with megaliths, but they are not by a long shot the only ones affecting the sites and being used by these sites.
Can you explain what telluric energy or current is?
Sure. Let me try. So telluric currents are a natural electric current flowing on and beneath the surface of the Earth. These currents are generally following a direction that is parallel to the Earth's surface. You can say that they arrive from chargings moving to obtain equilibrium between the regions of different electric potentials. Perhaps it's too complex to display this way, but these differences are, in their turn, set up by several conditions, including very low frequency electromagnetic waves from space, particularly from the magnetosphere, that then have impact on the Earth's surface, and this moves charge masses into the ionosphere and the atmosphere. So telluric currents are often used by geophysicists to map surface structures such as sedimentary bases, layered rocks, and faults. An anomalous current density of gradient may be indicative of a surface structural feature that are rich in this kind of currents.
So there are many, many different groups when it concerns history. Like you have the mainstream traditional group, then you have the Graham Hancock Lost Civilization group, and then you have the Atlantis one, and then you also have the one with aliens involved, and I'm sure there's many others. Where do you see yourself? Like, what kind of thoughts do you have regarding the origins?
Well, since every rule must have an exception, and since I am a non-absolutist, my only absolutism is that I don't have absolutism. So I think all those theories have their place. All of them are corrected. The problem is most people use them in absolutes. So they try to explain everything from the one they chose. And I tend to use the one that best suits every single situation. I do believe that something, I wouldn't call them aliens, but that's probably what they are. Something created man, because I, for one, don't believe in Darwin or its theories of evolution. It just doesn't make sense. I've studied biology. I've studied anthropology. I studied paleoanthropology. It was one of my first studies after my religious studies, because I needed to understand how things can evolve and to what point there can be some sort of evolution. What I found out, and this is confirmed by all major scientists in this, is there is no such thing as macroevolution. There are some exceptions, like a few shrimp-like creatures and so on, that can actually have macroevolutions, but that's it. It is not seen anywhere else in the biome of the Earth. And I will tell you more. The thing that I think is more convincing is that humans do not belong into the biome. We don't fit anywhere. It just does. We are not an animal per se. We came from animals, and I agree with that. I think that whatever created humans in their multiple forms, be it from all the species that we've talked to, that we see described from academics as being evolved, like Neanderthals, Gravettians, Denisovans, perhaps even Homo erectus, that I have done also a paper about, that live much longer than people suppose. I think all of those are actual Homo Florensis, for instance. I think all of them, that is what people call the Hobbit people, they all were created for a specific purpose. It was the time of the gods, as we see in myths and legends. So during the time of the gods, humans were being ruled and not ruling. And then you see the evolution of society came from the gods moving into the background. And then we have the sons of the gods, of the sun kings, or the people know more about Egypt, for instance, but they happened everywhere else. So humans were placed in the positions of power under the blessing of these creatures or beings, whatever you want to call them. So I think that, yes, aliens do play a part, but you cannot explain everything by saying aliens or whatever other description is, as you put it there. That's my point. That's my position.
It's probably impossible to populate the universe or travel as a biological creature. And perhaps it is some sort of sentient robotic creature that, because they can travel for millions of years without a problem, as long as they have energy, you know. So maybe they go to a planet like Earth and they bring with them whatever genetic material they need to create humans. And then when humans reach our apex, we create those robots, and it goes on like that.
Absolutely. Circles. Well, you see, in here I'm a little bit biased, because the work of my life is a book called The Helix Tree. And in this I explain everything since the creation of the universe into the present day. So it's quite a journey. That's why it isn't finished. But I've been working in it for almost 30 years now, gathering information. In fact, that's why I started gathering information in the first place. And to me, I think that the circles also are seen in some form of... Look, this is what I think actually exists. Although I have nothing against it, I'm not a fan of saying that the universe is completely populated by intelligent beings. I think that we as a species are an aberration even in the universe. Because what I think it exists is a creature that some call the watchers, others call the guardians, others call the teachers. I call them the shepherds. And these shepherds are a specific race that's created for each galaxy, keeping in mind that this is a book. They are created for each galaxy, and their function is to see life spreading and control that life in order for it to don't destroy itself. So what happens to me is that one of those creatures, just to make it short, because it's a very long, long, long story, some of those creatures decided to do things on their own, as many other characters in mythology, religion, and even in fiction like Tolkien, these creatures decided that they would create the world and the species in their image, so that they try to replicate God, or the All, the most powerful being, Anu in Tolkien, for instance. So that's how I think we came about. I think that those species were trying to flee from their galaxy. And will not describe the technical data here, it's a bit too boring. But what happened is they supercharge one portal in order to escape. And what happened is they came up in the planet that existed in our solar system called Phaeton, that is now it's now the asteroid belt. So the society of shepherds that at the time was not living on Earth, but on Mars, that created Cydonia, that created all those structures that we see on Mars, was partially destroyed, and the planet itself was very much damaged from the impacts received from the blocks from Phaeton that exploded. So those creatures since they couldn't move into where the other shepherds of our galaxy that I call the Sirians were forced to move into the Earth. So when they reached Earth, they found a planet that was spinning too fast, as you can see in the historical records, was spinning too fast. It didn't have a moon. The weather is completely unpredictable, and it was almost impossible beyond basic forms of life. And so what they did, they used the very ship that they used to transverse the portal, that I think it's the moon, and terraform the Earth. They slow it down, they bring it to a specific orbit, they bring it to a specific declination, they started to make it livable, and then when they came to Earth, that's when they start the colonization and the creation of men, because there were not many. They needed more people. So in this case, I think they took, I don't know if you're familiar with an animal, it's a very sophisticated animal, it's called a bonobo. Have you ever heard of him?
No.
Okay, a bonobo is the most advanced kind of ape. Not a simian, it's an ape. So bonobos were shown to the world by a very lovely lady that is Mary Ann something, that I can't remember the last name. I think she already passed away, unfortunately. And she showed the world that bonobos have no fear of fire. They can cook on fire. They can make fire. They can play computer games. They understand language. They can speak in language without having vocal cords because they can use their hands. So they are very evolved animals. And I think that these beings, when they reach here, they looked for the most advanced creature they could find, and they use it, mixing it with their own DNA or their own identity, biological identity. And that's when they created us, that are being so half gods. So the problem is, once we understood that we were half gods, they have to subjugate us. They have to create a society where we are completely grounded, where we are manipulated by fear, by news, by music, by art, where everything separates us, being from the new woke mechanism, being for sports clubs, being by politics, whatever. We are completely divided through a system that keeps us grounded so that we don't understand our true power as beings. Basically, that's it.
And this is, what kind of book is it?
Well, I will use Tolkien's words on this, because I dislike allegory in all its forms and shapes. So I call it fake history, although everything in it is based on some myth and some history, on some science. There is no actual gobbledygook that cannot be shown on a paper, on a study. So although theoretically some parts, but everything has been seen by science as possible.
I mean, if you look at a farmer who has sheep, he has sheep and he has a sheepdog that controls the sheep, but the farmer is the one who controls the sheepdog. But from our perspective, we don't consider this farmer to be evil. He's just like making sure the sheep don't run away and get hurt or get eaten by a wolf or something. So from that perspective, he's not evil. But from the perspective of the sheep, you could say he's the Illuminati, you know?
Yes, I understand your point completely. Yes. You see, I for one believe that many of the people that are oppressing humans, they actually believe that's the right thing to do, that we need to be controlled, that we need to be under some sort of law of exploitation. They think it's actually the best for us. Even the movement that was first created by what is a very famous figure today, there is Bill Gates. His father was one of the founders of the eugenics movement, because those people actually believe that the best thing to do for our planet to survive is to actually cut down the population by at least one quarter. When it is an empirical fact that populations, our numbers will not keep on growing. Our numbers will decrease as soon as we reach a certain threshold that it's not far. The numbers will quickly bottom up. So there is no need for any eugenics moving. In fact, even the the tale that we are being sold, that the Earth is becoming too small for all humans, it's completely ridiculous, because you can put every single person registered in this Earth in one single state of the United States, and everyone will have a little space to farm. So there is no point. This is all propaganda, but they actually believe it's the thing that has to be done. Some are quite evil, they are, but there are many innocent people in this that are taken by, imagine, for instance, Scientology. How many people were completely blind and thought it was the best thing in the world? It happens. People can be ludibriated into thinking that evil, acts of evil, are actually justified for an end.
Hmm. But from my own personal perspective, I highly dislike anybody trying to control me, at least.
And yet, do you think you are completely uncontrolled?
No, I have to. I'm not. I don't have fuck you money, if you know what I mean. Like, I still have to be part of the system to survive. You know, unless. You know, like, you know, so I'm still part of it, but less than others, I would say.
Sure. And I would also say very proudly that I only use the system in order to create means of survival, to generate a little bit of money that we are given for our work in order to actually survive and buy food and so on. But beyond that point, I don't belong to it, not at all. I don't agree with it, I don't support it.
One part of the system is also what people think they need. And like, I know people struggle and they might not have enough money when they retire, or they can definitely not retire early because they won't be able to afford living that way. So that's also a way I'm trying to break off from the system, is that I don't have a very expensive lifestyle and don't really have any expensive needs, really. So I can plan and do strategies to maybe have a very early retirement and still manage to survive, you know, because if I eliminate things that most people think they need, and I don't need those things, then that's a lot of money saved, you know?
Like a famous comedian that I don't recall the name, unfortunately, right now. It's one of my favorites. He used to say that people buy stuff they don't need with money they don't have. So that's how, that's one form of control. It's just novelty after novelty after novelty after novelty. Things, people change things they have just because something new came up and has a few more pixels or a few more capabilities and that they will never use. So humans are very, very easy to manipulate. Very easy. I used to say, and I keep saying, that one human is smart, a group of humans is completely dumb.
Yeah, I'm this spring I'm getting into my new project for future income, which is I'm gonna start keeping bees and producing honey, and it will take a few years to become a good beekeeper. So that's why I'm starting early, because I'm thinking like that's a perfect job also when you're old, because you only have to work half the year, the other half the bees are hibernating, you know. But I'm thinking it's a good strategy, because honey, after all, is called liquid gold.
Exactly, exactly. It's an excellent idea. It's an excellent idea. I live on a farm, and I don't have them because I have still to find, that is not easy in my country, to find a type of bee that has no sting. Because my father is completely allergic and he lives in the same farm, in another house, but in the same farm. So we don't want to take the risk that he has that he's stung and he might not reach the hospital in time. So that's the reason why I don't have them. So, but honey is one of the things that we here have very pure and always within the house. It's essential.
It's also good with all this climate change propaganda. You could use it to your advantage, because I've discovered that if you start a business making honey in the climate change disaster mentality world, that's a very positive thing to do. So they're very willing to give you money to do it, you know, like to give you what's it called when the government give subsidies and, you know, stuff like that, because they think, well, it's true also, you are helping the environment, but, you know, trying to find the, you know, trying to use what they preach against them, if you know what I mean.
Sure. Look, in the farm that I was working today, they have horses, sheep, goats, pigs, peacocks, ducks, geese, and the guy that is working there as the farm keeper or guard or whatever you want to call him, was using Roundup to kill the weeds in front of the house of the actual owner. So to me, it's completely idiotic, because people don't actually understand what they are doing. If that's to raise the discussion, that is, if you use Roundup from Monsanto or ever other company that is destined to be very strong and kill everything on the floor, you're going to kill the bees. And if you kill the bees, you'll have no orange trees, you have no vines, you have no wheat, you have no corn, you have nothing without the bees, nothing. You'll starve to death. And Monsanto almost did that in the United States, and it keeps doing, but although the Roundup is now less used, very much thanks to Holland, Germany, France, that were very quickly to forbid its use. In Portugal, unfortunately, it's still approved but you have to require a license to do it, and you have to prove that you are an actual extensive farmer in order to get it. But it's a completely idiotic thing that people do just to solve a problem when they are creating a very large one right after it. So I commend you for breeding bees, because that's what we need. We need more bees.
Well, I haven't started yet, but maybe they'll all die. I don't know. You have to learn. It's a learning curve, but at least I'm starting.
Yeah, as long as you have fields around you where they can get their food in a radius of 3 kilometers, I think it's the furthest they go, depending on the species. I think that you'll be quite all right, because they take care of themselves.
Where I live, drugs are highly illegal, and all drugs are the same. There's no cultural difference between when you talk to a politician or a normal person. That's not like alternative. There's no difference between weed or heroin. You know, it's all the same. Whereas in Portugal, I hear it's quite open or decriminalized, at least.
It doesn't actually happen in the streets. So what we do in Portugal is we have to go into the clandestine world, taking risks for those that don't have contacts, in search for their product of consumption, be it meat or be it in a solid state or being in a flower. You have to take that risk. You have to take the risk of taking it into your house, which if you are caught, you will go into jail if you have more than 499 grams, which is very little. And so what transpires to the other world, that we are very permissive, it doesn't really happen that way. So we have a politic that tried very successfully to abolish the consumption of heroin. The problem is they solved it with methadone, and methadone was killing people faster than the heroin was. So as you can see, it's all a system to take care and eradicate the certain groups from society. It's not as liberated as people saying it. Not at all.
But you won't get arrested if you have a personal use of any drug.
Oh, yes, you will. For instance, in case of weed, be it in flower or in solid state, if you go above 499, you go but it doesn't matter how much you have, they will confiscate it anyway. Okay, so it doesn't matter. You might have only half a gram of either of those two, and they will take it from you, and they will make a file. But if you go above 499 grams, they will take you into custody. They will take you into the police station. They will make an actual file, and you become registered in the legal system, and you have to go to the presence of a judge. Then you are forced to go into a rehab system, and this is the first offense, as they call it, because if you have the second one, you can go up to 5 years in jail. So it's not actually as pretty as people think outside Portugal.
When I hear stuff like that, it always sounds... I'm so amazed that so few people think like I do, that sounds so extremely childish.
It is, because as McKenna said, we should be allowed to make our own decisions. It's my body. I am the one who's in charge of what I put in or not into my body, right? But if I'm taking heroin and because it ruins my life and I end up in the street and start robbing people because I need money to the next dose, then it's a social problem. But if I buy weed to smoke in my house without bothering anyone else, that is my problem, not a society problem. And that's look, it has been many attempts to legalize cannabis products in this country. The problem is, and this will sound very aggressive, but it's the truth. While the government itself is controlling the traffic of psychotropic substances and making money illegally from it, it will never be legalized. Because, for instance, we have a very high deficit in our economics. And the legalizing of the weed itself on stores would solve that problem for almost 70% to 80%, because they could charge taxes and people would prefer to go to a shop instead of going to a bad neighborhood or something like that to get their own stuff. So it's all a matter of interests. And while there is interest in keep trafficking from the government itself, it will never be legalized. It has been, I've seen propositions from parties for more than 10 years now, and it's still not approved. In fact, the president of the Assembly of the Republic that is now retired, and he was that for more than 20 years perhaps, he was the number one trafficker in Portugal. So, and this is acknowledged, this is known, and yet nothing is done. So that's actually the problem.
Yeah, I just find it amazing that it's so childish and people don't see it. It would be like if I walked into my neighbor's house and told him he's not allowed to have the kind of couch he's sitting on. He has to have another kind of couch. You know, like that's how it sounds to me. Even when you're talking about heroin or any or whatever it is, you know, it sounds to me like that. You know.
but yes, it is quite absurd, completely idiotic that we cannot choose by ourselves. I think that was one of the biggest battles that Terence McKenna lost. Although he tried very hard to show the world that these are things that we all should have at least once in our lives, that we are talking about, not the one he mentioned as the heroic dose. I'm not advising anyone to take an heroic dose, be it of mushrooms or whatever form of cannabis, at least not alone or in a quite good setup preparation. But actually what you see here is that now in less scale, but we have a period where I don't know if you know the word, we call it raves. And the rave is, imagine a concert that it's done either in a closed warehouse or even in a wood, and people go with MDMA, and other substances, psychotropic substances, and they take them, and afterwards they spend 8 to 9 to 10 hours listening to punch, 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 punch. So they are this generation is completely fried up. Their brains just stop working properly. And that's an abuse of the substance, because people don't understand these are things that are ritualistic, they are spiritual, they are very much private. It's not something to do with, in Portuguese would be animlef, I don't know how to say it in English, but to do without conscious of what you are actually doing. So there are things that are wrong, but those things happen because there is no education, because it is not legal, because there is no information out about it. You just say, it's bad for you, don't take it. Well, that's exactly why most people start smoking, because they say, don't start smoking. And I'm talking about actual cigarettes and tobacco. So just don't say people that they it's illegal to do it. Just explain what they do, explain what happens when you take them, explain what you have to do to take them. And that's how I think it's supposed to be.
I always use the example when you're when I'm talking about if things should be legal or not legal. I always say that the reason I don't go around raping children is not because it's illegal.
Well, that's an extreme one, but yeah.
Yeah, but it's like completely irrelevant if it's legal or not. You know, like so. That's why I think it's ridiculous with all these laws, because The only reason I would follow a law is because I don't want to get fined or arrested, you know, like, but if there was no law, then many things I would do, but certain things that are built in, like natural law, like for instance, like killing somebody or raping somebody, I don't need a law not to do it, you know.
Look, if you see the pirates from Somalia, for instance, you have people that don't value life whatsoever. They don't care if they stamp an ant or kill a person. It's exactly the same thing to them. It doesn't care. They just don't care. They have no moral values on it. They have no bad dreams because of it. It's just something that is on their way. So you see that in Brazil, for instance, from the many robberies that happen. You see that in South Africa with the carjacking and killing people because you want the car. So society builds all these troubles. When look, we are spending, I'm not saying not to spend money in researching space or whatever. I'm just saying, because I love space and I think it should be done. I'm just saying that we shouldn't be using money that we say we don't have when there are people with hungry, there are people that are homeless, there are people that have no support, especially the elderly, there are children, there are growing up in terrible environments. There are no reasons whatsoever in our technology today for that to happen. No reason whatsoever. Don't tell me about economics and politics. That's just bollocks.
People think you exaggerate when you say it like this, but I honestly think that the COVID years were no different than Nazi Germany, and how a whole society had to bow to a certain agenda, and if you didn't, you would be an outcast. And people always say, like, well, it's easy to say now, but if you lived in Nazi Germany, maybe you would have been one of those who bowed. But I feel confident after the COVID years that I didn't bow to all of it. And luckily, I lived in a place that didn't do all of that craziest stuff, so I was very lucky with that. But I'm not sure I'm going to be as lucky next time, because the government here were really angry that they really couldn't do what they did in California and Australia. They really wanted to do it like that, but they just couldn't, because our constitution is written in such a way that you can't. And they really tried to change it, and they've been trying to change it ever since. And but it was also funny to see them, you know, wanting to be fascists, but they really couldn't, but they really wanted to, you know.
It's completely appalling and shows how, I'm sorry, I'm going to say it, how stupid people can be. Well, in Australia it was very dramatic. If you want to put it, the system that you talked before from Germany, yes. Australia was probably the most aggressive country of them all. They were getting people in their homes. And if you don't want to get vaccinated, you go to a concentration camp. And this is fact. So this happened. and people that didn't know their rights were taken, were actually taken by force. So it's just a matter of people don't have enough interest to go and look for themselves. They prefer the laziness of taking information as it is given.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for being on the podcast.
In a world veiled in mystery and driven by the quest for the impossible, join Alex on a transformative journey through the arcane art of transmutation. From ancient practices to the birth of modern science, we will uncover the secrets and stories of history's most enigmatic philosophers. The Natural Born Alchemist podcast presents a series that explores the trials, triumphs, and mystical pursuits of alchemy, the original quest for wisdom and power. Be sure to subscribe and unlock the vault of forgotten knowledge. Don't miss a single episode of this detailed telling of the history of alchemy, where we turn the leaden pages of history into podcast gold. Subscribe to the History of Alchemy on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and watch the video's version on YouTube and Rumble. Go subscribe there to The Natural Born Alchemist. Thank you.
I will leave Ricardo's links in the program notes and go follow him on X, formerly known as Twitter. In 2023, YouTuber Drew Binsky went to Papua Island, termed the last frontier, because its unique and nearly lost cannibalistic culture. Focusing on West Papua, Binsky navigated deep jungle challenges, spending two enlightening days with a local tribe. In the video he made, the Mamuna tribe is performing a beautiful song, and I want to play just that song for you, followed by a remix by someone called Daniel Hanson. So enjoy that, and always remember, freedom is in the mind.
And at least they built a handrail.
When they walk back, they sing through the forest.
That was amazing.
Oh, my God.